Hello, I'm Chuck Weiss, and welcome to Close Encounters. I'll act as your guide while together we explore the twin phenomena of UFOs and alien abduction. The UFO community has generally accepted 70 as the approximate number of alien species currently visiting Earth. When we come back, I'll present for you an alien program guide and describe 14 different species of ETs you may encounter.
It's sad but true, but every 2 minutes, an American is sexually assaulted. Take action today. Join RAIN in the fight against sexual violence and volunteer in your local community. Visit RAIN.org, that's RAINN.org, to find out how you can make a difference and turn the tide against sexual violence in America. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
A shooting star is not a star, is not a star at all. A shooting star's a meteor that's heading for a fall.
A shooting star is not a star, why does it shine so bright?
The friction as it falls through air produces heat and light. A shooting star or meteor, whichever name you like, the minute it comes down to Earth, it's called a meteorite.
A shooting star is not a star, it's not a star at all.
A shooting star is not a star,
a shooting star's a meteor that's heading for a fall.
A shooting star's a meteor that's heading for a fall.
A shooting star is not a star, why does it shine so bright?
A shooting star is not a star, why does it shine so bright?
The friction as it falls through air produces heat and light.
A shooting star or meteor, whichever name you like.
The minute it comes down to Earth, it's called a meteorite.
Earth, it's called a meteorite.
That was What is a Shooting Star by They Might Be Giants from their CD Here Comes Science. It's loaded with clever little tracks like that one explaining different factoids of science. There are approximately 70 different species of extraterrestrials that are visiting Earth. That specific number can be traced to Betty Andreasen Luca, an experiencer whose contacts with ETs are perhaps the most thoroughly documented. In comparison, only a handful of that number are generally known to the public. I'm first going to describe the three different species of ETs that are most commonly encountered in North America: the Greys, the Nordics, and the Reptilians. After that, I'll tell you about the additional 11 species of extraterrestrials of which I'm aware. First on the list are the short beings, about 3.5 feet tall, with large heads and big black eyes, who are commonly known as the Greys. They are the ones that most abductee experiencers are likely to consciously remember. That's probably because these little guys are usually the ones who come and roust you out of bed to deliver you to wherever you're supposed to go, and, when they're done, return you to your cozy nest at home. These are the two parts of the visit that people are most likely to remember, if they remember anything at all. They have been known to sometimes deviate from standard procedures and, instead of putting people back where they had picked them up, usually in their beds, the abductee experiencer might wake up in some other room or even outside the house. A friend of mine told me that she went to bed one night and woke up sitting on the commode in her bathroom. One researcher quipped that in these cases, the little guys must have been trying to save themselves some work and chose to cut corners by dropping off their charge at the corner, so to speak. I tend to think, though, that in those cases, it's probably done intentionally and according to plan in order to facilitate the awakening process. If you wake up outside your bedroom, it's a little hard to ignore that something is happening. I also think that a lot of the reported cases of sleepwalking are misdiagnosed ET contact experiences. These little guys are sometimes described as robot-like because they are often observed moving in unison like some well-rehearsed chorus line. I think this is a dangerous assumption. One wouldn't normally assume that birds are robots just because they are often seen in large groups turning together instantaneously in mid-flight. Instead, I think the grays might be clones, created to perform specific tasks like the alphas, betas, and deltas in Huxley's Brave New World, and linked to a hive mind that communicates instantly through telepathy with those who are connected. They have also been described as showing an almost childlike interest in things, which doesn't sound to me like the behavior of a robot. The small gray alien is well-versed in human anatomy, and they are the beings who perform the standard medical examinations and collect genetic material. A taller variety is often seen supervising the smaller grays. They're usually 5 feet or taller and are recognizable as individuals, as many people report interacting with the same tall gray throughout their lives. Some are described as female, while others, like mine, are male. I think experiencers are assigned the gender that they personally associate with authority. If the person responds best on a gut level to direction from a woman, then the supervising gray will be female, and if from a man, then male. I was told by my psychic friend Harold that my supervising gray has my genetic material, that he is, in fact, my son. I would speculate, though, that he has more than the customary single set of parents, probably being given DNA from several different sources. It would make sense, though, for the hybrid to supervise the parent. It keeps it in the family. It's generally accepted now in the UFO community that the grays don't come from a terrestrial planet like we do, but are actually from another dimension, or perhaps a parallel universe. Many encounters with the grays are extended to the astral plane and become out-of-body experiences, which also implies that they are interdimensional in nature. I also saw two grays materialize out of thin air in my apartment in 1994, an encounter that I describe in detail in my book, Abducted by Aliens. I'll tell you how you can get a free copy later on in the show. In my last podcast, I explained how I came to believe, along with several other researchers, that the grays are in charge of the mechanism of reincarnation and come from, as Raymond Fowler put it, behind death's great door. Whether they are material beings like ourselves who use Star Trek-like transporters, or are ethereal beings who must use technology to function in a material universe, the grays appear to us at different times to be from both realms. The ambiguity we are faced with when considering the very existence of interdimensional beings in our reality is reflected in quantum theory, where the subatomic building blocks of matter are seen as both something of substance, a particle, and at the same time as something unsubstantial, a wave. The grays can evidently choose in which of these two states of reality to move and function. I believe that there are more variations of the grays than can be distinguished by stature, tall or short, or by the number of fingers on their hands. Their knowledge of genetics is awesome, and I suspect that the grays have seeded their DNA throughout the galaxy, creating hybrids wherever they go. In fact, I believe that the human race is one of their hybrid creations, a view shared by many in the UFO community. Here is a list of some of the incredible things that grays are known to be able to do. 1. They can materialize out of thin air. I know because I actually saw two of them do just that in my bedroom on June 11, 1994. I saw them form over a period of about a minute or so. I kept my eye on one the whole time, except for a brief period when I closed them and counted to 5 before opening them again, in the customary fashion, just to make sure that I was seeing something real. The second gray was just inside my peripheral vision. It was the best confirmation I could have hoped for. It proved that my abduction experiences were real, and not just the product of an overexcited imagination. Whitley Strieber, in one of his books, reported seeing a chorus line of grays come out of his closet. In my book, I describe how my father also saw grays walk out of his closet. The point being, How did the Greys get in those closets in the first place if they didn't materialize there? 2. The Greys can paralyze people, freezing them where they stand. This widely reported paralyzing effect can be broken, however, by expressions of extreme emotion. In a book that Bud Hopkins wrote with his wife Carol Rainey, Sight Unseen, Science, UFO Invisibility, and Transgenic Beings, he describes an incident where a farmer was trying to protect his wife from some Greys by swinging a chain at them. As long as his anger was raging, they couldn't control him. In the incident where I saw two Greys materialize in my bedroom, I was immediately frozen when I tried to leap from my bed. I started to black out, but before I did, I screamed in my mind, "No, goddammit," and that broke their hold on me. 3. The Greys can levitate people. Again, pioneering researcher Bud Hopkins, in his book Witnessed, The True Story of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO Abductions, wrote about an incident in Manhattan where a woman was levitated out of her apartment window and up into a flying saucer in full view of witnesses on the Brooklyn Bridge. I've also read where abductee experiencers were levitated out of their beds and through the roof of their homes, which brings me to the next amazing ability that the Greys have. They can walk through solid objects. A number of abductee experiencers reported being able to walk through walls when in the company of their Greys. These were cases of physical abductions and not out-of-body experiences. 5. The Greys appear to be almost anything they choose, putting up screen images in place of what the person would normally see. Owls and insects are visual illusions that they often use as disguises. I described in my book how I woke up one time on a table with insects buzzing around me. 6. They can relieve a person's physical pain, as well as instill feelings of love and deference with their deep hypnotic stare. Their powers of mind control are considerable. 7. The Greys will sometimes heal people in extraordinary ways. I've described several healings I've received from my Greys in my book, and I'm not the only experiencer to receive such extraordinary healthcare benefits. 8. The Greys can manipulate time and space. I've read of several incidences where this appears to have happened. Streber described taking a freeway off-ramp once and winding up driving in a very alien-looking neighborhood. Back in the mid-1990s, Bud Hopkins wrote in his newsletter of an abduction at a poolside party where the person was led past other partygoers who were frozen in place. Linear time appeared to be switched off like someone had paused a DVD. That the Greys can do such fantastic things is not in dispute. What we don't know for sure is if they're done using advanced technological devices or if the Greys can achieve such results using just the power of their mind. Perhaps it's a little bit of both. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll tell you about the Nordics, human-looking aliens with blonde hair and perfect body shapes, and the reptilians, the Klingons of our galaxy.
The Homeless Prenatal Program, or HPP, works with families to break the cycle of homelessness and poverty. Seizing the motivating opportunity created by pregnancy and parenthood, HPP joins with families to help them recognize their strengths and trust in their capacity to help and transform their lives. The HPP is located in San Francisco at 2500 18th Street, or go online to homelessprenatal.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Muni Radio in San Francisco.
The Mosaic Project, based in Oakland, aspires towards a peaceful future by reaching out to children in their formative years. The Principal Program is a unique outdoor school which unites 4th and 5th graders with diverse backgrounds, providing them with the skills required to thrive in an increasingly diverse society, and empowers them to strive for peace. Mosaic creates a microcosm of the diverse, inclusive, just world we want to see, and shows the young students that peace is possible. They are always looking for youth leaders aged 15 to 21 to be mentors for younger students. Please visit mosaicproject.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio in the Bay Area.
Howdy! I'm gonna tell y'all a story you ain't gonna believe! It's about UFOs, big rigs, and barbecue. Well, I'm squishing armadillos out on Interstate 10. Heading out of Houston once again. Man, I've seen some shooting right across the sky. All covered in fur with one big eye. Shazam. So I stomped on my brakes with my baby on wire. Tuscaloosa, Alabama. You know what we got? We got Pips white bread and ice cold beer. He was eating so hard he didn't even stare. And that boy was ugly too. Said the waitress reminded him of someone who was far, far away. Took another white pill, another long day. Everybody now. UFOs and big rigs. Something that was music to my truck driving carbuncle butted ears, let me tell ya. Well, I'll pass Mars, ain't no speed limit. Said he owns a space truck, he don't rent it. And his back was aching, could he somewhere get him a massage? There stood Sapphire Space Age Love Garage. Come on, well, UFOs are big rigs.
Welcome back to Close Encounters. That was UFOs, Big Rigs, and Barbecue by Mojo Nixon. I wonder if he's any relation to our 37th president. I dedicate that one to truckers everywhere who see things in the sky at night while we're asleep in our beds. Listed second in this alien program guide are the Nordics, sometimes called the Tall Blondes. These are very human-looking people with blonde hair, blue eyes, and Hollywood-perfect body shapes. The men are muscular and the women well-endowed. Abductee Travis Walton saw this type of ET while aboard the saucer that had taken him. Mr. Walton appeared with his friend Mike Rogers at a UFO convention that I attended. Rogers is a respectable artist and presented slides of his work that depicted what Walton described seeing aboard the saucer. One painting was of two Nordics, a man and a woman, that Walton encountered while on board. During the question-and-answer session that followed his presentation, I asked Mr. Walton if these human-looking beings were really as buffed as depicted in the painting. He confirmed that the man had an excellent physique and that the woman was quite shapely. Depictions of the Nordics by others who have encountered them are quite similar to what Walton reported. To me, the perfect body form of the Nordics suggests cloning in order to produce the same perfect result each time. As we know, standard mating and birthing procedures produce different-looking results. Your kids don't look like the neighbor's kids. Even within the same family unit, children will have different body types. Such small differences might be difficult for us to discern when looking at an alien who looks very different from us, but the Nordics look very human indeed, with no apparent imperfections. As an aside, I want to say that they also remind me uncomfortably of Hitler's concept of the Aryan Superman, blonde and blue-eyed perfect specimens of the human form. Let me also say something about the movie Fire in the Sky that was based upon the abduction of Travis Walton. According to Mr. Walton, everything depicted in the movie was essentially correct, except for what was shown aboard the UFO. All of those horrific scenes were totally made up. There were no body parts floating about the ship. He wasn't tortured, nor did he have his eyeballs probed. Walton was also fully clothed when he was left beside the highway 5 days later, not naked as depicted in the movie. The film was released in 1993 and is probably part of a series of movies that turned Hollywood's portrayal of UFOs and alien contact from the positive optimism of Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. the Extraterrestrial to a decidedly negative spin with such films as Independence Day and Mars Attacks. In the fifth episode of these podcasts, titled Hollywood vs. the Aliens, I describe in detail Tinseltown's role over the years in molding public opinion about alien contact. Check it out. I think you'll like it. Next up are the reptilians. These are not very polite people. You might call them the Klingons of the galaxy. My sense is that they are not evil, per se, unlike the Borg, to keep the Star Trek analogy going, in that one might successfully negotiate with them. More like the Klingons of Star Trek The Next Generation instead of the original series, a more civilized version of that warrior species. Their rough handling is apparently used sometimes to crack the shell, so to speak, of particularly hard-nosed abductees during their awakening process. Dr. Mack saw it this way, quote, "Even the form in which the beings themselves appear may have symbolic meaning for the abductee, possibly reflecting some currently relevant element of consciousness. Reptilian forms, for example, could be linked with aggressive elements, luminous beings with higher levels of consciousness or self, and so on," end quote. I suspect that once the awakening is well underway, though, the reptilians drop into the background and the greys take their place. I might have had contact with a reptilian myself, I'm not sure. A lady friend of mine once described hearing something when she stayed over one night. She described it, quote, "like a dog walking on linoleum with its claws making that clicking sound." I actually have hardwood floors. She was too afraid to look, she said, and after a few seconds fell asleep. Just before she did, though, she glanced over at me and saw that I was lying on my back with my eyes wide open but unconscious. Many months later, after our relationship ended, I was lying in bed with my face to the wall when I heard that same sound coming from behind me, like something with claws walking on my hardwood floor. I also was too afraid to turn around and look, so I can't say for sure that it was a reptilian, but I suspect it was. In addition to the greys, the Nordics, and the reptilians, there are also the tall praying mantises. They look exactly like the insect, but 7 feet or taller. They're generally described as gentle beings. The tall albinos, described in Alien Agenda, Investigating the Extraterrestrial Presence Among Us by Jim Mars. There are the Nomo, that's N-O-M-M-O. I'll spell out some of these so that you can research them if you like. The Nomo are three-eyed amphibious beings from the Sirius star system and celebrated by the Dogon tribe of Mali, West Africa. They're described by K.G. Temple in his book, The Sirius Mystery. The Dropa, D-R-O-P-A, is a name given to an alleged race of dwarf-like ETs who landed near the Chinese-Tibetan border in approximately 10,000 BC. Also on this list are the Blues, passionate spiritual beings with bluish translucent skin, described by Robert Morningsky, an Apache Hopi Indian experiencer. The Hopkinsville goblins are silvery-looking creatures about 3 feet tall. And there are the blue dwarfs, as described in Communion, a true story by Willy Strieber. The Pascagoula creatures took Charlie Hickson and Calvin Parker in 1973 while they were fishing on the Pascagoula River in Mississippi. These beings piloted an oblong craft, not a circular disc. The Braxton County Monster is known from a 1952 sighting in West Virginia and is also known as the Flatwoods Monster. Mothman is the name given to a strange creature reported in the Charleston and Point Pleasant areas of West Virginia between November 1966 and December 1967. It was described as a winged man-sized creature with large reflective red eyes and large moth-like wings, and often appeared to have no head, with its eyes set into its chest. A movie was released in 2002 about these sightings, starring Richard Greer. And finally, to wrap up my alien program guide, there are the three-eyed Voronezh beings. That's V-O-R-O-N-E-Z-H, sighted in Voronezh, Russia, by several children close up and by adults at a further distance. They were reported to be 9 to 10 feet tall. If you do an internet search of these aliens, be sure to include UFO as part of your search criteria. Searching Voronezh by itself, for example, will only result in Russian tourist information. Let me wrap up this segment by saying something about people who would name a specific species of ET as being bad aliens with only evil intent toward mankind. What I've read of this paranoid kind of thing is not well reasoned, to say the least. It is at best representative of a fearful point of view and, at worst, an example of professional disinformation and deliberate fear-mongering. No less a personage than Dr. Wernher von Braun, the man in charge of our space program up to and including Armstrong's walk on the moon, was quoted as saying several times that of the many species of ETs visiting Earth, quote, none of them are hostile, end quote. We're going to take another break now so you can hear these important messages.
And now, coming to the stage, a public service announcement from the Laughter Foundation. Are you funny? Do you exhibit signs of being a comedian? Do you find yourself constantly making a room full of strangers laugh? Do you find yourself stressing out about not knowing where your next comedy gig is coming from? Do you sometimes find yourself depressed for no apparent reason? You may be suffering from being a stand-up comedian. My name is Stephen Allen Green, the founder of the Laughter Foundation. We here at the Laughter Foundation know that with comedy creativity often comes natural side effects such as depression and confusion. I urge anyone who is suffering from depression, especially professional stand-up comedians, to seek out professional help immediately. Therapy literally saved my life. Plus, therapy can help you creatively. Don't suffer silently. Your demons are just hecklers who can be thrown out of the comedy club in your head. Contact your local psychiatric services and don't be ashamed. Get the help that you need and deserve. If you are feeling imminently suicidal, contact the local suicide hotline immediately. And contact us too. We always have new ideas and can connect you to a mental health care professional. Don't feel ashamed. We understand and support you. After all, there is no greater nobility than making the world laugh. And sometimes, that's just a bit too much of a burden. We need and must take care of our own. Thank you for your time and for your services to the comedy community. Find us at thelaughterfoundation.org.
Davy Crockett, traveling through outer space.
Reborn in the stratosphere and Saturn bound, flying fast and miles off the ground. Jumped from the spaceship just to look around, and shot off his gun without making a sound.
Davy, Davy Crockett, king of this brand new place.
Davy,
rocket traveling through outer space. Off went his rocket at the speed of light, flying so fast there was no day or night. Messing around with the fabric of time, he knows who's guilty for there's even a crime. Davy, Davy Crockett, the buckskin astronaut. Davy, Davy Crockett, there's more than we were taught. Hiding in the cargo was a robot drone, programmed to destroy Davy's spaceship home. Davy switched out his brains, now the drone's a dog clone. Named him Copernicus and threw him a bone. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of this brand new place. Davy, Davy Crockett, traveling through outer space. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of this brand new place. Davy, Davy Crockett, traveling through outer space.
Welcome back to Close Encounters. That was Davy Crockett in Outer Space by They Might Be Giants. It's time now for the final segment of Close Encounters, where I read from my book, Abducted by Aliens. It's also available, all 369 pages, as a free PDF download at my website, abductedbyaliens.org. Also, if you care to, you can contact me at that website. Last week, I listed the symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome that I was suffering from, and how my friend Lila tried to reassure me that there were prosaic answers for all my concerns. And finally, I recounted how reading Communion by Whitley Strieber triggered a memory from childhood of a missing time incident when I was a young boy living with my mother and grandparents in Oklahoma. So picking up where I left off, reading from my diary on page 25 of Abducted by Aliens, or How I Learned to Cope with High Strangeness, Government Harassment, and My Mother, A True Story, copyright 2008. Referring to my suddenly remembering the incident of missing time in Oklahoma, I wrote on Wednesday, April 6, 1994, "Emotionally, I feel better than I have in months. It's as if a great weight has been lifted from my shoulders. I know now that I'm not crazy, and that is a relief. But still, every night as I prepare for bed, I experience what many American soldiers must have felt. It's as if I'm on night patrol in Vietnam, never knowing if I'm going to engage the enemy. Last night I got little sleep at all, having forgotten to take my medication. I woke up in a flash, heart pounding to that familiar ring of a phantom telephone. Like Pavlov's dog, my body reacted with a full-blown panic attack. The clock on my nightstand read 2:40 a.m. By the time I calmed myself down to try and sleep again, it was just past 3 o'clock. I don't think I fell asleep, though. My mind wouldn't stop racing. Therefore, I was surprised to roll over in bed and see that the clock read 5:55 a.m., It hadn't seemed to be more than 15 minutes, or a half hour at most, since I had tried to go back to sleep, but the clock said that almost 3 hours had passed. Did I sleep so lightly that I thought that I had only closed my eyes for a few minutes, or was this another missing time episode? A few nights ago, I remembered an old James Bond movie where he wanted to know when anyone entered his hotel room while he was away. He carefully secured a strand of thread across the door jamb so that it would fall to the floor if the door were opened in his absence. Taking a cue from 007, I have been placing a small cardboard box up against the door every night before retiring. If someone were to enter the room while I was asleep, the door which opens into the room would move the box aside. Although the box was firmly against the door when I got up this morning, it was a couple of inches from where I had carefully placed it last night. Either this is really happening, or I have very complicated hallucinations. Late evening. I had a rabbi friend of mine over tonight. We had made the date a while ago when I was fearful of my own sanity and felt that I needed some emotional support. He was relieved to see that I wasn't as distraught as I had sounded when we last talked on the phone. I had him sit down and read my journal as it stands to date. This saves a lot of time and ensures that I don't leave out any important observations. He deferred judgment, but did say that my list of symptoms ran the range from post-traumatic stress syndrome to schizophrenia to full-blown psychosis. He also agreed that regressive hypnosis would be the only way to know for sure what was happening. I told him of my concern for Catherine, my 8-year-old daughter. She hasn't slept in her room for over a year now, insisting on sleeping with her mother instead. My wife Margaret and I thought at the time that Katie was reacting to our separation, but she had told her mother that it was because there were, quote, monsters and bad men in her room. There was another girl who had been sharing the room with Katie. 6 years ago, Dorothy, who is now 14 years old, came to live with us. She shared a room with her mother Maria, who had been our live-in housekeeper and Catherine's nanny since Katie was a year old. Of course, as Dorothy grew older, she preferred to share a room with Katie rather than always being under the watchful eye of her mother. Margaret purchased a pair of bunk beds for the room, and both Katie and Dorothy seemed pleased with the arrangement. However, Dorothy moved back to her mother's room when Katie started sleeping with her mother. I would think that a teenage girl would find it a stroke of good fortune to suddenly have a room all to herself, but evidently not. Now, no one sleeps in that bedroom. It has been said that alien abductions are often generational, involving both parent and child. Is my Katie involved in this thing, too? Did Katie and Dorothy see something in that room that frightened them so much that they both preferred to give up their privacy rather than sleep there again? I told the rabbi that I was planning to ask Katie to draw wanted posters of those monsters and bad men for the police. He agreed that it sounded like a good idea and that it would be interesting to see what she comes up with, but he cautioned me to be particularly careful not to give her any subconscious suggestions as to how to draw her pictures. At that age, children are susceptible to the expectations of adults, especially those of their parents. I asked the rabbi about the ethics of dating. If aliens are indeed abducting me, could I, in good conscience, have any kind of intimate relationship with a woman if it meant that she might be abducted as well? Or should I live alone the rest of my life rather than risk subjugating others to what I'm going through? He said that there were probably many women who would be attracted by the idea of a relationship with someone who is intimately acquainted with extraterrestrials, and that I should let any prospective girlfriend decide for herself. What a pickup line. Do you want to come over to my place, stay the night, and meet E.T.? Friday, April 8th. Last night I let my friend Robert Atkins read my journal. I thought that he had said that he had read Communion, but I had evidently misunderstood him. Whitley Strieber is one of his favorite authors, but he hasn't read that particular book. His reaction has convinced me to be much more careful as to whom I come out to on this subject. It's just like Bob, though. He's proud of being logical about things and not swayed by emotion, but he's also closed-minded. He has no interest in the UFO phenomena, much less encounters with their occupants. To him, every mystery must have a rational explanation, and any extraterrestrial explanation for lights in the sky can't be rational. He should reread Hamlet. There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, Robert. We then watched the movie Communion, the screenplay of which Strieber adapted from his book. I had bought it, but I hadn't seen it until now. As we watched the movie, I was struck how my own life has paralleled that of Mr. Strieber's. Strieber had been obsessed with home protection and had purchased a shotgun for that purpose, even though his home had never had a break-in. He also bought an expensive alarm system for their cabin in the country, again without any prior provocation. I, too, purchased a gun and an expensive alarm system for home protection. I have long had a paranoid belief that the end of civilization was near and that hordes of hungry and desperate people would swarm over the countryside, raping and pillaging when the new Dark Ages began. Shortly after we got married, Margaret and I purchased some undeveloped property in Northern California to use as our retreat for when this would happen. I realize now how paranoid we were, but at the time, Margaret and I shared that nightmarish fantasy. The movie also reminded me of the many times last year when, for no apparent reason, certain house lights would turn off and on repeatedly. A check of the fuses never revealed anything out of the ordinary. Also, lights that I knew that I had just turned off would suddenly come back on. I joked that I had a gremlin in the house. These incidences finally subsided, and I haven't had any trouble until recently. During the past couple of nights, there have been several times when I knew I had turned off the basement lights, but found them to be on later when I returned. Since my recollection of the missing time episode in Oklahoma, my mental attitude in regard to these visitations has become quite positive. I want to see this thing through. I want to know what I'm involved in. I'll accept a normal explanation for these strange events if that is what is revealed, but I have to know. Saturday, April 9th. Last night I wanted to see if my new positive attitude would help me to sleep without the aid of something pharmaceutical. Besides, I was dog-tired and felt certain that I would drop off quickly once I got into bed. Not the case. I tossed and turned for 2 hours before getting up and finally taking a halcyon tablet at 4:30 a.m. Between then and when I got up this morning at 9 o'clock, I remember hearing the faint, distant ring of a telephone 2 different times. I didn't take note of when they happened. I was too tired to open my eyes and look at the clock as I usually do. Besides, since I hear these rings so often now and can tell them apart from the actual ringing of my phone, I don't have to respond to them. When I got up, I saw that the lid of the gift box that I keep against the door at night had become warped and was curled upward at the edge. Yet it hasn't rained or been particularly humid. Also, that box has been in my bedroom for several months before I started using it as a detection device, and this is the first time that it has been bent out of its original shape. Could whatever force they used to put the box back into position after their visits have caused it to warp like that? Sunday, April 10th. I wrote a poem last night which describes the conflict between my desire to take these visits as a positive experience in my life and the sense of helplessness that I'm often left with afterwards. I believe it's the feeling of not being in control that triggers my body's panic reactions. Even as I write this now, I feel my heart rate quicken with anxiety. I got to bed at 2:30 in the morning after taking my halcyon tablet. The sleeping medication kept me unconscious until 8 o'clock, when I woke up in a state of mild agitation. I took my pulse, and it was higher than accepted norms, but not as bad as during a full panic attack. I was still very tired and decided to try and sleep some more. I don't remember any dreams during the first sleep period. This is usually the case when I sleep so lightly, but this time I had a long and pleasant dream that ended when I woke again around 11 o'clock, feeling fully rested. I want to describe it here because I think that the symbolism is fairly obvious when examined in the context of my nocturnal visits. I'm on some mass transit system, bus or train, with many people, and we're off on a vacation. I don't know any of them personally, but they're all a friendly lot. We get to the resort, and I'm assigned to take the group in a small open motorized shuttle from the office area out to the cabins. The route I take is unpaved and confusing at times, but there's someone there walking outside the shuttle who helps me navigate the path through the woods. At last we reach the cabin area, but our rooms are on the roof of a building that is 2 or 3 stories tall. We all climb the ladder attached to the outside of the building to get to the roof in our separate rooms. In the dream, I've been traveling with a small girl about Catherine's age, although it's not obviously her. She looks to me to guide and protect her and expects to share my room with me. Meanwhile, a woman has taken a specific liking to me and wants to bunk with me instead. But what of the little girl? She expects me to stay with her. It's okay, I'm told. There's another child she can stay with. I'm assured that she won't mind switching rooms, and, to my surprise, she doesn't. Well, this vacation is turning out to be fun. Here is a beautiful woman who wants to be with me with the expectation of friendly sex. In fact, after the group gathers and has dinner, my female companion can hardly wait to return to our cabin for exactly that reason. In fact, she is in such a hurry to begin that she literally pushes me up the ladder to the top of the roof where our love nest awaits. When we get to the roof, we find a lively party in progress. I meet a man who seems friendly at first, but later he assaults me by throwing a bomb in my direction. It misses me and fails to go off. It's then that I see that it's a big firecracker, the implication being that it was meant more to frighten than to harm. The others immediately grab him and tell me that there is nothing to worry about, that they won't let him try to harm me again. To detain him, they press him up against the wall, while a few of the partygoers accompany me to the office to call the police. When I return again, climbing the ladder to get to the roof, I find that the madman is loose again and angry as hell. He does a series of high acrobatic somersaults, much like Daryl Hannah did in the movie Blade Runner. Giving me a glaring look, he charges directly at me, doing those somersaults. He purposely doesn't stop, going past me instead and over the edge of the roof in an angry suicide. I look down and see that he's still alive, although badly hurt. People come and take him away, and again, the group reassures me that I needn't fear him anymore. The party picks up again, this time with me as the guest of honor. The woman whom I had met before continues to flirt with me. She's good-looking and quite likable, so off we go to the bedroom. Everybody gathers to watch through the door, which has large glass panels, but I prefer privacy and drape a sheet over the door to block their view. However, this doesn't deter their good-natured curiosity, and they try to peek around the edges of the sheet anyway. I woke up at that point feeling completely rested and peaceful. The dream gave me all that I needed, the casting out of anger and fear, reassurance that I was not in danger, and friendly support from people who seemed to really like me. It even suggested a motive for their intrusion into my life, peeking through the door, that of genuine curiosity. In reality, I'm sure there's much more to it than that. I suspect, though, that a great adventure lies just ahead of me, trying to figure out what that more is. I'm going to recite now the poem I wrote the previous night. Confronting the Boogeyman. An unknown creature visits me at night. With big dark eyes, he fills me with fright. He shatters my sense of peace and well-being, coming and going all the time unseen. Like a leprechaun, he pokes and teases. Nothing can stop him. He does what he pleases. But as I stare at him, lying there in my bed, shaking with fear, my soul full of dread, the thought comes to me that I do not know if this creature I see is really a foe. If we live our lives thinking we're in control, finding we're not takes a physical toll. My heart is pounding and racing, a full panic attack, but it's an instinctual reaction, nothing based upon fact. For as I see it, he has done me no harm. It's just my body that sounds the alarm. My mind instead wants to perceive that which he has for me to receive. Answers to questions I don't think he'll tell, for we make our own heaven and we make our own hell. But I can use his visits to shrink or to grow. This is my choice, that I now know. My body, I'm sure, will recover in time. As I reach for the stars, it will follow behind. Copyright 1994, Chuck Weiss. I'm going to stop there and take one more break. When we come back, I'll tell you about next week's episode of Close Encounters. But first, please listen to this.
Podcast operator, how may I help you?
I'm looking for this really cool podcast station.
There are a lot of really cool podcast stations. You're going to have to be a little bit more specific.
Well, I'm not sure what it's called anymore. I went through a lot of changes. First there was Pirates.
Pirates?
And then there's a bunch of initials, PC something. I really didn't get it.
No, I don't see anything under Pirates or confusing initials. Could you tell me something more about the station?
Well, I had an amazing following.
Like a cult?
No, not like a cult, more like a collective. A
cult collective?
Whatever, bottom line. People listened to it. It was good.
What made the station so good?
Well, for starters, there was 30 unique radio shows.
That sounds like a lot.
Because it is. They had local and world news programs. open mic poetry slams, live bands, comedy shows, local world music shows, Spanish language, Greek language, community organized, centered shows, even a show about 420.
Weed? There was a show about weed on this station?
Yeah. And get this, half their DJs are women.
I like that. What kind of music did they play?
Everything, house, techno, hip-hop, garage, soul, world, new, old, uptown, downtown, underground, vinyl. It was really cool.
Well, I looked all through the database, and I could only find one podcast station that fits that very description.
Really? You found my station. Are there pirates or animals, a bunch of initials I won't remember? What the hell is the name of the station?
Mutiny Radio, it says here. Mutiny Radio.
Mutiny Radio? Mutiny Radio?
Yeah, Mutiny Radio.
Well, that's a good name.
You're listening to Mutiny Radio. Same great station, new great name.
Welcome back to Close Encounters. That was Space Cowboy by the Steve Miller Band. I apologize for the abrupt ending, but that's the only copy of the song that I had in my library. Close Encounters is produced at Mutiny Radio, located at 21st Street and Florida in San Francisco. Besides hosting a wide variety of podcasts each week, Mutiny Radio serves the community as a venue for a host of entertainment and educational programs. Are you in a band looking for a cheap place to perform? Perhaps you're a comedian who has always wanted to book your own show but thought you couldn't afford it. Mutiny Radio has a 40-seat performance space for rent, cheap. You handle the admission at the door, charging whatever you like, while we manage the sound system. All you pay is one half of the receipts, or $100. Get this, whichever is less. That's right, we'll take the lesser amount because we want to help you express yourself to the world. For more details, contact our station manager, Pam Benjamin, at Pam Sedai, that's PAMSEDAI, all one word, at hotmail.com. All good things must come to an end, even my podcasts. Check me out again next week, when I'll be giving advice to those who think they might be involved in this thing called alien abduction. Until then, look to the skies.
All right, so the other day, I was talking with Michael Stipe. We were talking about the very first memory you had, the very first thing that comes in your head. And, dude, I think I sort of freaked him out a little bit. Because when I was about 3 or 4 years old, me and my little brother, we used to go out in our backyard. And we'd go up on top of the swing set up there. We'd climb up on top. It was Mark. And we'd climb up on top of the swing set, and we could sit up there up all night, and we'd watch these drive-in movies that were about, you know, like a half a mile away over on this hill. We'd just sit up there all night, and we'd watch the movies. Okay, and we had a pretty good view of, like, the sky there. You could see the sky pretty good as we were watching the movies. Okay, one night we're out there, sitting up there watching movies like usual, and we're watching on the horizon there, 6 UFOs. No kidding. Our formation. Really? I mean, they're right there in formation. There's 6 UFOs right there, okay? So we're just little kids, okay? And it sort of freaks us out a little bit. So I get down. I get down off the swing set, and I go in to get Mom, because that's what you do when you're a little kid. You just go get Mom, because weird shit's happening. So by the time I come back with Mom to check it out, they're gone.
Dude. Yeah, I knew that.
Okay? And so no one believed me. Okay, so I'm about 10 or 11, and me and Mark are playing football in this field by our house, okay? Mm-hmm. And we've had about enough. We've been playing for a while, and we're getting ready to go in. And we're walking to the house there, okay? And this is real. It's the same sort of deal. You can see the sky pretty good, and the sun's sort of going down, but it's still pretty light out. You know what I mean? Okay? And we're walking up there, you're viewing the horizon, and no bullshit, the same 6 UFOs are right there in formation.
Oh, that's heavy, dude.
Right there, dude. I know, man. It's right there in formation. But we don't freak out this time, okay? Because we saw them.
They were ready.
We sit there, and they're right there, hovering right over our heads, man. And we sit there, and they come closer and closer, and we're just sitting there. There we go. We're waiting on them. They're coming towards us. And they made this really weird sound. I mean, I'll never forget. It made this sound. It sounded like this.
Thank you.